Alright, and welcome to another programme of Out and About. Now, in our last programme of Out and About, I talk with Columban missionary priest Cyril Lovett, who in the year 1968 went to work on the missions on the southern Filipino island of Mindanao. After spending his first year involved in pastoral work in a place called Tubod on Mindanao Island, Cyril next went to work in nearby Osamas City.
My second job was as secretary to Bishop Cronin and Chancellor of Osamas. Now, it sounds a big title, but it wasn't, except that there was a very competent man in the job before me. And the great gift of that was Bishop Paddy Cronin, living with him in the house and learning from him. He would have been one of the ones who spent the war years. He had been in the first group that came to Mindanao, and he was a delightful human being, just a wonderful man. The only thing that upset him was if anybody spoke against the Filipinos.
He was a patriot true and true. Obviously, he'd lived through he had seen it all, I'd say. I mean, did he ever talk about those vicious war years? I mean, what happened in the Philippines? You know, just horrific. I mean, that occupation, it goes down in history for all the wrong reasons, but did he ever talk about it? Ever open up?
Oh, yeah, he would talk about it. But, of course, you see, he had some of his own classmates there. And you don't get away with much from fellow Columbans, and especially if you're put in a position of authority. So, fortunately, he had the good humour to be able to go with it. But I remember he would say things like, when I would comment, let's say, if there was a marriage or a feast or a celebration, birthday, something like that, we would be invited. And there would be piles of food. And everybody headed straight for the table. And you loaded your plate down. Now, I couldn't take too much of it. But Paddy Cronin certainly would load his plate. And I remember talking to him about it afterwards. And he said, when we lived with the people in the hills during the war years, we had practically nothing except rice and a few vegetables. So if ever there was a feast anywhere, we would be the first in line. And you certainly filled your plate.
And you appreciated it.
He understood perfectly that at a feast, what might have been normal to us was certainly not normal to the people. And once you understood that, you see, it was those kind of insights that he gave me into the people. And, of course, his love for the people. Now, he would know when he was being fooled, but he was accustomed to it.
Take it on the chin and, okay, here we go. Might as well get a roll with it.
Exactly, yeah. But I am grateful, always grateful, for the 3 years that I spent with him. Then in 1969, I think late 69, he was made Archbishop of Cagayan, totally against his will. And so I moved over to that place, which was further east. And
still in Mindanao.
Still in northern Mindanao, yes, but a bigger city, much more developed. The Jesuits had a university there, Xavier's University, and they were very kind to him, actually. They'd had a Jesuit bishop before that, but they were very welcoming and they appreciated Paddy's gifts. So, in 1972, I went home on holidays, and 71, and when I came back, it was a very different situation. In 1972, martial law had been declared.
Ferdinand Marcos as president, his tyrannical comes to mind. You know, this kind of this is an autocratic, tyrannical man. You know, and things are not going well for the Philippines.
That's right, and particularly in the kind of skirmishes that had been becoming much more frequent in Mindanao with among the Muslims and the Christians, that increased, and he foolishly declared martial law. I think foolishly, and then proceeded to try and persuade the Muslims to give up their weapons. Now, the Muslims had always been armed back from the 16th century, and they weren't going to give up their weapons for him. So, at the time, there was an attack on Marawi City, which would be the Muslim capital, and most of the Christians fled, even though there would have been about maybe 30% of the population there. And so when I arrived, there were very few Christians left in Marawi. Not only that, but there was a university in Marawi called the Mindanao State University, which was set up as a joint venture between Christians and Muslims. It would have a staff that was, it would have a Muslim administration, it would have a staff that combined Muslims and Christians, and the students would also be half Muslim, half Christian. And Christians were attracted to it because they were given scholarships. So the poorer students saw the opportunity of getting a university education. There had never been a priest on campus, but the bishop of the place, Benny Tuttut, wonderful man, saw this as an opportunity. And so he said to me, what about if we sent you to Marawi? Because you have a degree from Oxford University, let's see how they will react to that. So I remember going up with him by jeep. We met with the president of the university, and the bishop introduced me, and the president would be very, very happy if I would be a lecturer on his staff. Also, I could be the chaplain to the Christian community on the university campus. Initially, there wasn't any place to stay, so I went up and down from Iligan City. But there was an excellent man who was the bursar, a fiscal in charge of the university, who was a Christian. And he had been taught mathematics by a Columban, and was a great Christian. And he didn't know, he had a house on campus, but didn't live in it. And he suggested to me that I could live in his house. So that was how I got to live on campus. Now, I spent 4 years there. It was a war zone. There was 27 kilometers between Marawi and Iligan, the first Christian town. And in that 30 kilometers or so, there were 27 military barricades, as it were, you know, that you had to pass. And each one marked the sign of the side of an ambush.
So this was an area where, you know, I mean, you know, things can go wrong very, very quickly, and you're living in the middle of it.
Very quickly, yes. And the on campus, generally speaking, there was certain safety, but hearing gunfire and automatic fire was quite often an occurrence, you know. And what I remember from that period was that while I was there, I adapted to it. But each time that I would come out for a holiday or for a break, I would be immediately aware of how much tension I had lived under. So that was another 4 years.
So was your life ever in danger? I mean, you know, you kind of, you know, you're in a situation which is a conflict situation, and there's the Muslims and the Christians, and things are not going well. There's a historical legacy there, very familiar to our own island, the northern part of our own island, you know, and so this is. Not a good situation to be in, and you're in the middle of it. Life ever in danger?
Not at that time. Not at that time. The main danger would have been in travelling, as I did once a week, down to Iligan and back. And there's a funny story that I tell that, you see, the folklore was that if you killed a Muslim chicken, you not only had to pay for the chicken, but all the descendants of the chicken as well. And so you were very careful as you drove that road. But my driver, who was also my cook, he drove. He believed the faster we go, the sooner we'll get there.
And we won't be shot.
Exactly. So one day, as we were travelling, a blessed chicken decided to cross the road, and I heard the soft thump, and Carlos said, "We're not stopping."
So for chicken and descendants, we're heading on.
Right. So when we arrived on campus, I presumed that we'd hit the chicken and would be found on the side of the road. But when we arrived on campus, I found people looking at the front of the jeep and laughing. Oh, God. When we stopped, eventually, we found we had brought the chicken with us.
What's for dinner?
Yes. So,
and tell us, just regarding your work lecturing in the college,
yes.
What was it? What did it entail, and what were the challenges, sir?
Well, basically, the students were very good. Because if they were Christians, they were quite bright to have got scholarships to be there. They were intent on getting a degree, a good degree. The Muslims, some of them were lazy. Some of them, however, were from rich families and wanted to go abroad. So they wanted a good degree. And
so like every college, you had your mix of the eager, hungry students that are eager to get on, and the students maybe that are more lackadaisical.
That is right. No, the Muslims have their own language, but English was the language of the campus, and all the students could express themselves in English. Not write very well, but could certainly express themselves. So I was able to teach in English there.
And what were you teaching, sir?
I taught what I had learned. I taught geology. I taught the beginnings of social anthropology, a bit of stratigraphy, and maybe some physical and human geography.
I'd say you really enjoyed it now. I'd say it was kind of, we were talking over the phone just in pre-interview research, and it was very obvious you loved anthropology and geography and the whole, history of migrations and how the movement of people down through the, not only the centuries, but the millennia. Would it be right?
Yes, well, I enjoyed it, yes, certainly. And I come from a family of teachers. So I have always been happy to teach. And also we had a small chapel built beside my house, and we built it in the design of the Muslim art, and we celebrated sitting on the floor, and we tried to adapt a little to the culture.
Make it as ecumenical and as open as possible, a tolerance rather than, narrow-mindedness.
Well, that is true. And you see, because we were all under pressure, all Christians there, there was another college on the far side of the town run by Americans, Baptists, and we had very good relationships with them. And It was interesting. They were called the Van Vactors. Later on, one of them was kidnapped after my time there, and as was one of the priests who took over from me. Actually, Sean McDonough was the one who took over first, and then later on...
Sean McDonough, the famous eco-theologian who's written numerous bestsellers on climate change and so on. Yeah, sorry.
That's right. And also another, a Frenchman who had taken, who was chaplain there. But there's... I don't know that there is a Catholic chaplain at the moment, but certainly for 20 years after I was there, there was a chaplain, and he was accepted.
And for those of you who've just tuned in, I'm Paul Wright, and you're listening to Out and About. Thus far in the programme, I've been talking with Sir Lovett, a Columban missionary priest, who left Ireland in the year 1968 to go work on the southern Filipino island of Mindanao. Now, Cyril got to the point in his story where he worked as a lecturer and also college chaplain in Mindanao State University, situated in Marawi City in the Philippines from 1972 onwards. By the way, Marawi was riven by conflict between Muslims and Christians at the time. Now, staying with my interview with Cyril Lovett, I also asked him how his college chaplaincy work went.
This was a very special situation, really, because you would have anything up to 200, 300 Christian students. And really, the only support, our counsellor, our on campus, would have been the Catholic priest.
Yourself?
Yeah, yeah. And they were, as I say, very... cooperative and friendly wherever you met them. But it was still a lonely outpost. And now that I reflect on it, it was the only time in my life that I had a dog. I'm not one for pets, but I realize now that it was to relieve my loneliness. And it's the only time in my life that that has happened. And the dog was a pup and grew over 18 months or so. And then one night he disappeared. And I'm afraid he ended up as a dish, because dog would be considered a delicacy. And obviously a well-fed dog from the Catholic chaplain. He didn't survive.
Wow, God, it just goes to show. And this is the cultural, when you go to a different society with different issues, this is what you're faced with. I mean, unbelievable. You couldn't write it.
That is true, yeah, yeah.
And so just continuing with your story, okay, you're 4 years there,
yes,
in Mindanao and teaching in the college there. Now, what year did you finish up there?
That was in 1976. I went for home vacation again. Now,
a well-earned bit of a respite, you know, time out from a conflict situation. You can relax a bit, you know, and you're not as tense. And yeah, what happens then?
Well, what happened then was that when I went home, I found a changed situation. Because even when I'd been home on holidays in 1972, Dad hadn't been well. He was liable to depression, and it was very difficult. Mom was on her own, three sons, halfway across the world.
On the other side of the world.
Yes. One younger brother at home, but he was 14 years younger than I. And one sister who was no longer at home either. So while he was at home, he was ill again. And I said to myself, I cannot allow this to go on. This isn't right. So, with a sinking heart, I asked for a home appointment so that I would be closer to the home situation. Now, at the time, mainly in Ireland here, it was a question of being on promotion or else being in administration or one of these things, and neither really appealed to me very much. But beggars can't be choosers, so I asked for a home appointment. And I was asked if I would take on a job as what was known then as the education officer. That is to say, it was a kind of a coordinator of seminary education and ongoing education for the society. I would report to the central administration, who lived that time in Killiney, and are later on in Dunamead, and there would be a lot of travel involved. And actually, this provided me with a very interesting next 6 years, where I travelled to every mission of the society.
All over the world?
All over the world.
Wow.
And where I had a chance to visit the seminaries, to inaugurate some new programmes. It was during my time that we started the overseas training programme, whereby the seminarians would interrupt their studies after philosophy. They would be sent for 2 years to the missions at a young age to learn the language there, to learn something of the culture, to be able to help in some way, and then come back, finish their theology, and be assigned, hopefully, back to the same mission.
So it wasn't just all theory, there was actual pragmatic, hands-on experience, you know, in the field, you know, which you can't beat. University of Brick Lane, as some people would dub it.
Yes, it was a very good idea. And the hardest part of it, perhaps, was that you had to be in a different culture without a role. You see, if you were an ordained priest, that was very different. But I admired the students who came in, who had to be children again to learn a new language, a new culture, and to find some little place where they could help in some way.
In other words, they were dependent, they were vulnerable, and a good recipe for learning.
Oh, yes. I think it was a very good program, and it is still running. And we also, this was the wake, remember, I took over in 1977. It was after the Vatican Council, and we had made any great efforts to adapt and to renew ourselves as a society. So I began to promote various programs and courses in the United States and in Britain and in Ireland, where Columbans who were on vacation could take a month or 3 months or even 6 months renewal program. And then we set up our own renewal program here in Dalgan called the Faith and Mission Program. And that was a wonderful venture, really.
Why?
Why? Because, frankly, we felt that we had something to offer ourselves that Columbans would not find anywhere else. We, in the latter years in Mindanao, a few of my colleagues, Peter Leonard and Sister Elizabeth Moore, and especially Sean McNulty, they had been involved in what I would call experiential learning. And this was for a formation program of 6 weeks for ordinary people from the barrios, farmers, fishermen, who would come in, whose family would be cared for by the rest of the community while they were on this six-month course, and which would be based especially not on learning, as it were, from books, but rather a sharing of their own experience, a deepening of their own experience and of their knowledge of Scripture as
applied to everyday life.
Life, exactly.
In other words, the application, it's all in the application.
Exactly.
You can have theory till the cows come home, but if you can't apply it to real life, real people, real problems, where are you going?
Exactly. So, two of my friends had attended what was known in England, and it's still known, as the Leicester Conference. The Leicester Conference was based on experiential learning, and it was 12 days in length. It was very stressful and wonderful learning instrument. And my two colleagues told me that years after they had done it, they were still learning from it. And I said, any instrument that can enable you to keep on learning like that, we must include in our program.
Why was it so effective?
Why was it so effective? It was so effective because it's an excellent learning method. It was adapted to the people. It was based, it valued the experience, the lived experience of the people, and it related to that so that they could go back and share some of this among their own community. It involved development of leadership skills. It involved consciousness of what happens in a group, of how people learn. And it was grassroots stuff.
So basically what you were doing is you were plucking people from out of the community, people that, you know, would have been interested in this, and giving them the skills to be leaders in their own communities.
That's correct. That's correct.
And profuse thanks to Cyril Lovett for a great interview. Until our next programme of Out and About, from myself, Paul Wright, bye for now.